It seems ecology, economics, and politics create the mirror for how things are looked at today. Add taste, and the seafood industry begins to unravel. Paul Greenberg, author of American Catch, dives a bit deeper and tells a better story. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. Well, Paul, I thank you so much for sharing your time with us today. What do you feel created the dots to follow in writing American Catch after the success of your previous book, Four Fish?
Well, I continue to fish. I continue to enjoy the ocean. That's sort of where I find my sort of center of gravity. And when you try to write a book, you're always kind of looking for a toggle point, I think, you know, especially if nonfiction is your bailiwick. The toggle point in Four Fish was the fact that for the first time in history, we were about to have more farmed fish than wild fish in the marketplace. So that was the toggle point there. For this one, though, it really started with something that happened in my neighborhood. I live right near Ground Zero, and I had moved there somewhat unhappily. I was happy in the person I was living with, but not happy with the neighborhood. It was very sort of corporate and banky and not really particularly local in any kind of way. But one day I stumbled upon the Fulton Fish Market, which is down upon on the East River. And this was 2005. And I was really excited to see that there was still this last little vestige of waterfront trade going on in New York City. And at one time, the Fulton Fish Market was the largest fish market in the world. And so I was really excited. I thought that I would make this sort of the center of my life down here in Lower Manhattan. But a few weeks later, I came down to the Fulton Market, and it was gone. It had moved up to the Bronx, and New York, Manhattan had lost its last waterfront market. And that's when I started delving into this toggle point, which was that in addition to the Fulton Fish Market having left the neighborhood, local fish in general had left the country. And subsequent research revealed that even though the United States controls more than 2.8 billion acres of ocean, more ocean than any country on Earth, more than 85% of our seafood is imported. So that was my toggle. It was, you know, why in a country with such incredibly vast marine resources is so much of our fish coming from another country? And, you know, it was a nice avenue to explore many things I wanted to explore.
Yes, and you do state early on that the fishing industry, like all industries, has really fallen prey to or become a statistic of ecology, economics, politics, and taste. So this is almost like a jumping off point for you. So in beginning this tale, or perhaps reasons for writing this book, you just mentioned we are a seafood debtor nation. Maybe you can say, like, why are we? I mean, is it for the simple reason when we call a big corporation, we're actually speaking to someone in India because it's cheaper over there? But are other people fishing our waters? Give us a little bit more detail about all of that.
Sure. Well, part of it is economic, and a big part of it is ecological. From the economic perspective, even though 85% of the seafood that we eat is imported, we actually export about a third of what we catch. What we're exporting is generally high-quality wild fish and shellfish, things like New Bedford sea scallops or Alaska salmon. Something like 80% of our Alaska salmon we export. In return, we get pretty cheap farm stuff most of the time, or about half the time. Tilapia, farmed salmon, farmed Pangasius catfish, a fish that actually most people don't even know we eat, but it's actually the sixth most consumed seafood in America. So we're selling abroad the expensive wild stuff, importing a lot of farm cheap stuff. And I should note that of the wild stuff that we import, about 30% of the wild stuff we import is actually caught illegally outside of any kind of management regime. And so, of course, it's cheaper if it's caught illegally. So that's the economic side of things. From the ecological side of things, we have, as a nation, historically not respected the places where seafood wealth is born. And those places tend to be mucky, buggy, oystery type places. In some cases, it's salt marshes. Salt marshes usually are at the mouths of estuaries. They are very, very fertile places. They often will account for something like 60 to 70% of the seafood that we eat requires a salt marsh for some portion of their lives. And then oyster beds are also really, really critical. A presence of an oyster reef, from a little bit of the research that I've looked at, seems to double the presence of seafood, other kinds of seafood that will be in that area. Well, if you look at these two critical pieces of ecological infrastructure, you'll see really massive declines. We've lost something like 60 to 70% of our salt marsh in this country, and something like 80% of our wild oyster reefs. And so, you know, those two pieces right there are very big. And then the last portion, which is sort of discussed in the third portion of American Catch, the salmon chapter, is the interface, you know, the energy between land and sea, which is represented by rivers. In this country, we have over 85,000 dams on all the rivers in throughout the United States. And that's just things that qualify as being called dams. There are probably over a million obstructions that are blocking rivers and streams all over the United States, which block the transfer of energy from, you know, fish like herring, salmon, sturgeon, shad. All these fish migrate out to the ocean to feed and then spawn in fresh water. And then there are eels, of course, which go the opposite direction. These are all pieces of biological energy that are blocked. I often like to say, I often hold up a map of the state of Connecticut during my PowerPoint presentations, and I show all the dams, and there's like 3,000 dams in the state of Connecticut.
It's such a tiny place.
I often say that this is why people in Connecticut are so uptight. Their chi is blocked by all these dams. So if you look at it, rivers, salt marshes, oyster reefs, those three pieces of ecological infrastructure are highly, highly impaired, and I think account for a certain amount of poverty in our seafood supplies.
Yes, and just those things you mentioned right there, I wanted to comment on certain things that you wrote about. And regarding that lovely little oyster, I had no idea what it does. What a wonderful little thing. It filters up to 50 gallons a day of water. That's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing for a creature that is about the size of the palm of your hand. To have this kind of amazing biological filter that can literally, as you say, filter up to 50 gallons of water per day per individual. And, you know, that seems like a lot, but if you want to really grasp the scale of it, look at how many oysters we used to have. The Greater New York Bight, which is what we call the sort of geographical territory that's inclusive of all the bays and inlets of Manhattan, Brooklyn, Queens, Staten Island, and the Bronx, the Greater New York Bight had several trillion oysters at one point up until the 1820s. And imagine if each one of those trillions of oysters is filtering 50 gallons a day. You have a situation whereby the entire New York Bight would have been filtered completely every couple of weeks. It's a profound, profound ecological change from what was versus what we've got.
Another vote for Mother Nature. How incredible.
Indeed. And, you know, it's not just filtering. Oyster reefs oysters are the only bivalve, you know, clam-like thing that build in three dimensions. And one of the things that oysters actually need to grow are other oysters. So when an oyster dies, or its shell remains, and when oyster larvae, which are called spat, come to be swimming in the water, they look for other oyster shell to fall down and set, and then grow themselves into another oyster. And oyster upon oyster upon oyster gradually builds up these reefs that can be, you know, dozens of feet high and sometimes even break the surface of the water. If you imagine Manhattan, Brooklyn, Staten Island ringed by these kind of natural defenses, you can see how a certain amount of storm surge could be mitigated by the presence of oyster reefs. And in fact, there's a term that one of the characters in American Catch throws out there called oyster texture. And her concept is that if we could somehow seed oysters back into the New York Bight and get them to start growing again, it would do a lot in terms of providing natural seawalls and reducing storm surges all around the greater New York area. I mean, it's very theoretical. It hasn't been proven yet, but I think it's a very interesting concept.
Yes, absolutely. And the other thing I loved, actually, you know, we're reading about all these facts in American Catch, and then you throw in something that's very esoteric and perhaps simple sounding, but really has such a profound meaning. And you mentioned regarding the aquaculture, for instance, and the damage incurred, you bring up a very keen insight about how it eventually makes marshes and estuaries having clean systems irrelevant by the fact, oh, we don't need that. We've got aquaculture. And
well, I mean, that's right. You know, I am not opposed to aquaculture as a system of producing food. And in fact, if you, you know, look at it compared to, say, land food production, to grow, I don't know, a salmon, for example, is much less energy intensive, much less carbon intensive, much less food intensive than growing a cow, for example. And that's all well and good. But when we, as I think I say in American Catch, if we put all the processes of an estuary basically into a bottle, all of the intricate, complicated exchange of fresh and salt water, the thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of microorganisms and species that make a living estuary work. Well, if we pare all that down to the very simplistic formula of, you know, feed in salmon out, or, you know, feed in shrimp out, it makes the world a poorer place. And, you know, part of the big dilemma, as I'm sure you've encountered with other guests on your show, is that Americans really are not comfortable confronting deficit in any way, shape, or form, or depletion. And so we've historically, as a nation, always turned to other countries to mask the abundance that has been eradicated in this country. Oftentimes, I think it was Peter Matheson who called America a country that grew gray before its time. And I think things like aquaculture can be complicit in masking the fact in how very much we've made the country age, respective to, you know, our arrival in this continent.
The other piece that comes up along with this mindset is that I loved when you were writing in regards to the sockeye salmon in Alaska's Bristol Bay. There is definitely pipeline looming and all this other stuff. And you mentioned that the hope could be springing from the spirit of the land itself. And it's a very simply stated sentiment, but a very powerful one, because if it even just takes a little bit of earthly matters away from man's mentality of I'm in control, I've ruined this, now I fix it, I think there's more of that that needs to, you know, obviously let the earth do its thing in some ways.
Yeah. Well, yes, I mean, I, before going to Alaska, had never experienced what really untrammeled nature looks like. And sure, I'd been up to the Adirondacks or even in the continental American West, but even those so-called wild landscapes are heavily, heavily changed. You know, like the Adirondacks of New York State have all been logged over once, if not twice. The American West have had huge shifts in river courses due to dams, as well as all sorts of other things that have impacted on the landscape. What was amazing about going to Bristol Bay, Alaska, in Alaska, which is, you know, the third part of American Catch where I look at sockeye salmon, and Bristol Bay has the largest sockeye salmon run left in the entire world.
I know, it was amazing.
Once you go there and you see this place that produces 40 million fish every single year, you're kind of blown away by how much territory you need to maintain an intact natural system. And it kind of, it's like a slap in the face to humans. I mean, I think we, you know, especially like for me living in New York City, you can trick yourself into thinking that, oh, hey, we can do a riverfront park and we've brought nature back to us. We have this project here in New York called the Million Trees Project, where, you know, they're hoping to plant a million trees within a certain amount of time. Like, the huge scope of, you know, really unbridled nature that produces natural abundance. And so, I mean, I kind of almost recommend that every American go to Alaska and see what we've got left and understand that this is the way natural systems should look, and we need to protect them before they actually fade from our ability to even imagine them.
actually, we are showing signs of recovery. And I'm wondering if you can tell us, with all that you've seen and researched, what visible forces are you seeing?
Within the United States, the first step in trying to fix our fishery situation started probably in the 70s, along with, you know, so much other really positive environmental legislation. During that time, right around the same time as the Clean Water Act was passed and the Clean Air Act was passed, and I should say the Clean Water Act is huge as far as starting to restore some of the water quality that we need to have abundant fisheries. But beyond the Clean Water Act, in 1976 was passed the Magnuson-Stevens Act. And that act started to really address the question of sovereignty of our home waters, and also over the, you know, starting to figure out what was a sustainable harvest. I mean, the 76 Act didn't do that much as far as defining overfishing and insuring against it, but it provided the basic architecture whereby we could then add on other things. And we did add on. In 1996, there was an addenda put on to the Magnuson-Stevens Act called the Sustainable Fisheries Act, and it mandated that all American fish stocks be evaluated to determine whether or not overfishing was occurring, and if it was occurring, it had to be stopped. And it mandated that all American fish stocks had to be rebuilt by a certain date. And we're actually coming up on that date. Now, we haven't achieved universal success, and there are people out there who criticize the rebuilding targets. But over 30 different stocks of fish have been rebuilt to the federally mandated targets, and more seem to be on the way. So, you know, that to me is an argument that we can, as a country, exercise restraint, and we can, as a country, understand that when we eat fish, when we eat too much and we fish too poorly, that we're taking away the abundance of future generations.
Yes. What are the global links that are shared in the fishing industry with problems here in America?
The global links?
Yes.
Well, I mean, fishing is a very international trade, and it has always been. If you read Mark Karlansky's excellent book, Cod, you learn all these things, like, for example, that codfish, New England codfish, was actually one of the points in the triangle of triangular colonial trade, which we all learn about when we study American history, that industrial goods were sent from New England in exchange for indigo, and in turn, New England was actually, I think, when industrial goods were coming from England, they would go to New England, and New England would provide salt cod for the American South, and the American South would in turn provide cotton and raw materials to England. So a key point in that triangle was salt cod, which was used primarily to feed slaves in that part of the country. So that was, you know, one example. But right now, the way that globalized fish trade works is that there are these huge processing hubs for fish, a lot of them in Asia. And in fact, a lot of people don't realize this, but a fair amount of salmon, of squid, things like that, that are caught in this country get frozen here when they're caught, sent to China, defrosted, processed in China, you know, deboned or filleted or whatever, refrozen, and then they come back to us double frozen. So it's ubiquitous in the seafood trade, this kind of endless reprocessing and transshipping. And it's a very, very complex globalized system. And, you know, to some degree, I think a little bit too globalized. I think that there needs to be a way to figure out to cut out a few links in those chain and connect the consumer a little bit more directly with the fishermen, just so that we have a sense of where our seafood is coming from.
Yes, and it's great. There are people, we are all aware at this point in time about the farm-to-table system, mentality, use, etc. And there are those doing dock to dish now.
Yes, dock to dish, sea to table, you know, ocean to plate, all these kinds of names have cropped up. One of the most encouraging things in that is this movement, which are called community supported fisheries. And it's, you know, quite similar to what, you know, is known now as community supported agriculture.
Yes, the CSA.
But these systems, you know, allow people to subscribe basically with a producer of seafood to buy a yearly subscription. It gives the fishermen some startup capital at the beginning of the year, which they very much need. And then in return, you get a certain amount of fish every single week, or depending on what the deal is, every month. And you can be guaranteed that it came from your local waters and it came from your local fishermen. And I think it's, you know, the prices are often competitive with what you'll find in the supermarket. They're not competitive with Chinese farmed tilapia, but they are competitive with other wild-caught species. So I think it's a really good deal for both the consumer and for the fishermen, and I'm hoping that we can see more of these develop as we, you know, move ahead into sort of exploring the next phase of local food. I mean, local land food is now more than just a flash in the pan. I just saw recently that the number of farmers markets since 1994 went from about, you know, 1,200 to well over 8,000 in the last 20 years. I mean, that's a remarkable achievement. And we only have about 35, maybe, community-supported fisheries at this point. I think we could have a lot more, and I think we could have a lot more local businesses built around seafood. We've lost a tremendous, tremendous amount of fishmongers in the last 20 years. We've fishmongers and individual fish markets in the last 25 years went from controlling three-quarters of the seafood trade to now less than 20%. And meanwhile, supermarkets have gone from controlling, you know, not very much of the seafood trade to something like 80%. So it's a real shift, and I think it's to our detriment that we've had this shift, and I would like to see some of it shift back towards the local fishmonger, towards people who are actually knowledgeable about the fish that swim in our own waters.
Yes, and I think that there is going to be a trend, and I think you're just a part of that trend, and we don't quite see it yet.
No, well, I think we'll see more and more of it. I mean, it's, you know, it's a wake-up call, and people are starting to understand it. And they're starting to understand the value of it. But, you know, I think the one problem that fishermen have versus farmers is that people have a generally kind of a warm glow around farmers. They think of them as stewards of the land. They think of them as good people to have on the landscape. They will fight to defend farmers. Whereas fishermen often get the reputation as just being kind of rapers of the sea and not really in sync with nature in a constructive way. And certainly they can be that way, but there is a way for fishermen, I think, to develop more of a collaborative role with, say, environmental organizations. You know, the case of Bristol Bay in American Catch that I point out is that it was really fishermen who fought this huge copper and gold mine that was proposed for the bay. It would have entailed the extraction of over 10 billion tons of ore in a seismically active area, right next to the spawning grounds of some of the best salmon on earth. Had fishermen not really come together and waged a significant protest, I think it's possible that that mine would be going forward at this point. And as it stands, right now the Environmental Protection Agency has started what's called a 404C action under the Clean Water Act, and they do have the capacity within the EPA to stop the mine, which would be a great victory for fish and fishermen.
Indeed, yes. Your research did bring you very far and very wide, and I'm wondering if you would just tell us a little bit about the Thai shrimp market that you were researching.
Yeah, well, I would say my research was actually, my on-the-ground research was in Vietnam, but subsequently, certainly a lot of stuff has come up in Thailand. But yeah, I spent a lot of time looking at the shrimp industry, and as your listeners may or may not know, shrimp is the most consumed seafood in America by far. We eat about 4 pounds per person per year, which is almost as much as the next two most popular seafoods combined, salmon and canned tuna. So the reason, though, we eat so much shrimp has to do with this incredible biotech revolution that occurred primarily in Southeast Asia from about the 1940s through the present day. And because a group of scientists figured out first how to domesticate a shrimp in Japan called the Karuma prawn, all those researchers fanned out over all over Southeast Asia and began shrimp domestication programs all over the place. Most recently, though, you know, what's been in the news lately about shrimp, and, you know, I should say that shrimp does have potential. I mean, it is a very fast-growing animal. You can get multiple crops a year, especially in these very hot climates like in Thailand. But it's also a system that we've pushed very, very hard and perhaps too hard. Recently, in the last year, well, actually the last 4 or 5 years, a disease called early mortality syndrome has been sweeping over Southeast Asian shrimp farms. And last year, Thailand lost about over $1 billion in shrimp crop. In addition, the Guardian recently reported that the people who harvest the little fish that are then ground up and made into shrimp feed, that a certain number of those vessels seem to be impressing slaves onto their boats to catch this shrimp feed. So, you know, to me, if there's a human rights issue and there's also a disease issue, it indicates to me that the system is being pushed too hard because we're trying to get a cheap commodity out of something that maybe shouldn't be so cheap and shouldn't be so, you know, profligate in its use of resources.
Yes, and it's just all round not a good idea, just as all of the big government is starting to fall over and the big food industries
right.
and farming is falling over. It just becomes obvious, you know, all of the diseases that happens to the chickens and everything. So once again, it's a good message to know where your fish comes from. So that will
yep.
be, I'm sure that's, you know, people more and more are going to be catching on to that. And and it's just following in, as it followed down that dark dungeon into big industry, is following, finding its way out as well. You know, there's just one more thing that I would like to maybe ask you before we finish up today, Paul, and that's in regards to writing this book, American Catch. Did the book end up what you thought it would when you started out to write it?
It's a good question. When I first started to write it, actually, I'd originally proposed it to my publisher to be a book about the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. And, you know, I started out reporting the book to be that kind of book, but it was funny. I was out in the Gulf, actually, I was out in Lake Pontchartrain, talking to, you know, shrimping with a, you know, an old school fisherman. And we were talking about the oil spill, about this and that thing about the oil spill. And at a certain point, he turned to me and he said, you know, the real issue here isn't the oil spill. The real issue here is the loss of the control of our seafood system. And that's when it really dawned on me that I needed to change courses and needed to really address this whole issue of the huge effect that foreign imports have on our seafood economy. So, you know, it was also funny things happened along the way that kind of helped the narrative a lot.
Bravo, yes.
When I started writing the oyster chapter, I had no idea that the biggest hurricane in, you know, half a century was going to hit Manhattan and completely prove the thesis true of all the oyster texts out there, that New York was basically an unguarded shoreline because we'd removed so much of the natural oyster reef. So it kind of proved my point. And, you know, in lockstep also, these things happen, like the Thai industry with shrimp and the early mortality syndrome, you know, busted out just as I was finishing the chapter. And then in lockstep as I was writing, the EPA set up a notice in Alaska and started to think about actually protecting Bristol Bay. So it worked out. I mean, you know, it's sort of a proof of concept when events follow your lead to some degree. I mean, you can't always get that lucky.
Yes.
But I felt I was in sync with something, and I was happy with how it came out in the end.
Author Paul Greenberg, American Catch. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, sign up for weekly programming, and read about our newly developed 501c3 project with Sea Minerals to remineralize our soils, go to tributariesradio.wordpress.com. And for podcasting on iTunes, Tributaries.